BBC Radio 4 FM, Damien Lewis continues to read from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, the new biography of the great American playwright by the theatre critic John Lahr. Today, the recent success of A Streetcar Named Desire continues to reverberate. In his personal life, Tennessee's tempestuous relationship with Pancho is at an end, but new opportunities await him.
On December 30th, 1947, 4 weeks after the clamorous opening of Streetcar, Tennessee Williams sailed for Europe on the SS America. It was his first transatlantic trip abroad as an adult, and he was going solo. He said,
"I don't intend to get seriously involved with anyone ever again."
Streetcar had set off a seismic shift in American theater. It had also triggered a shift in the playwright himself. For Williams, who was now earning $2,000 a week in royalties, austerity and anonymity were things of the past. On the day of his departure, the attention that the other grandees of the theater lavished on Williams signaled his new power. Jessica Tandy, Kim Hunter, and Montgomery Clift showed up at the disorganized playwright's apartment for a packing bee. Elia Kazan arrived with champagne. Later, crowded into his stateroom, the group presented him with a dozen white shirts, a cashmere sweater, and a bottle of scotch. Clift brought with him a portable Hermes baby typewriter, a reminder, if Williams needed one, that it was time to get back to work. In Europe, the parade of celebrities continued. Greta Garbo recommended his Paris hotel. Louis Jouvet, Jean-Louis Barrault, and Jean Cocteau, the nabobs of the French theater, turned up to dine with him. By the time Williams arrived in the Eternal City, fascism and the Second World War had more or less sealed it off as a destination point for the American traveler. Even in its ravaged, recuperative state, Rome quickly became for Williams the capital of my heart, a soft city. After less than a month abroad, Williams wrote to Kazan,
"I haven't the slightest idea what I'm doing over here."
By the third month, his uncertainty had turned to impasse. He had fallen, he said,
"under the moon of pause. Sometimes the lamp burns very low indeed. For the past 5 or 6 days, I've been battering my head against a wall of creative impotence."
Sex, the trapeze of the flesh, as he called it, was his antidepressant. It swung him away from his writer's block and into life. Cruising, with its drama of enticement and invasion, of appearance and disappearance, was particularly thrilling in Rome. He wrote,
"In the evenings, very late, after midnight, I like to drive out the old Appian Way, park the car at the side of the road, and listen to the crickets among the old tombs. Sometimes a figure appears among them, which is not a ghost, but a Roman boy in the flesh."
By June 1948, when he went north for the English debut of The Glass Menagerie, he felt distracted and as nervous as a cat. Britain's drabness and snobbery sank his spirits. He wrote to his friend, Donald Wyndham,
"To really appreciate Italy fully, you should come to London first. Christ, what a dull town and what stuffy people. I've actually been compelled to start working again, which is a sign of real ennui."
At Brighton's Theatre Royal, where the play was in tryout before its London opening, he had to contend with the First Lady of the American Theatre, Helen Hayes, who was playing Amanda, and with John Gielgud, the play's director. Hayes informed him that the show was in trouble, and Gielgud asked him not to take a bow at the curtain call. "I don't want the beautiful effect of this play diminished by a perspiring little author with a wrinkled shirt and a messy dinner jacket coming up on stage." Williams had been skeptical of Gielgud from the beginning.
"He is too English, too stylish, too removed from the subject and spirit of the script,"
he said to his newest English friend, Maria Britneva, a pert, high-spirited actress of white Russian origin whom he had met at a party.
"I'm resolved to take a bow if there's even the faintest whisper of author in the house."
In the end, Williams went one better. He bowed out entirely. His fear of the play's failure compounded by the prospect of a reunion with his mother, Miss Edwina, who traveled to London for the first night, proved too much, and Williams fled to Paris. Maria Brittney exerted an almost immediate power over Williams. Almost immediately she made herself indispensable, clipping the British reviews for him as he hunkered down in Paris, sending him gifts, doing his laundry, and dispensing a lot of crisp, straight talk. Over the decades, Britneva would become Williams's 5 o'clock angel, as he dubbed her. Exhausted after a day's writing, he could always find her waiting at the other end of the phone to fill up his emptiness with plans and amusing badinage. Britneva was variously friend, court jester, dog's body, confidant, cheerleader, keeper of the flame, and finally, in his last will and testament, legal guardian of his sister Rose. In September 1948, Williams returned to New York to attend the rehearsal period and Broadway opening of Summer and Smoke. The almost uniformly dismissive reviews, a pretentious and amateurish bore, mawkish, murky, maudlin, and monotonous, confirmed Williams' assessment of the director's mediocre job. If the reviews to Summer and Smoke took the shine off Williams' public glory, his private life had taken on a welcome new luster with the reemergence of Frank Merlo. One night, soon after returning from Europe, while walking down Lexington Avenue around midnight, Williams spotted Merlo in a delicatessen. He hadn't seen him since their passionate one-night stand on the Provincetown dunes a year before. Merlo was with a Navy friend. Williams invited them both back to his place on East 58th Street to picnic with their roast beef sandwiches and potato salad. When Merlo's Navy buddy left to catch a bus back to New Jersey, Merlo stayed on. Williams wrote a plaintive poem, Little Horse, a nickname given to Merlo by Britneva because of his large front teeth.
Something started or something stopped, and there I was, and there was he, for it was late, and I was lost.
There was nothing lost about the pragmatic Merlo, who was 27 when he reconnected with Williams. Polite and well-spoken, Merlo was almost exactly the opposite of the quixotic, unlettered former lover Pancho, the mere news of whom sent a frisson of dread through the Williams camp. Williams appointed Merlo his personal secretary and factotum. When he and Williams went to Hollywood in the summer of 1949, after almost a year together, so that Williams could lend a hand to the screenplay of The Glass Menagerie, the Hollywood mogul Jack Warner asked Merlo, "What do you do?" "I sleep with Mr. Williams," Merlo replied. He also ran social interference for the shy playwright. Williams's hysterical outbursts, his paranoia, his hypochondria, his infuriating vagueness. These were nothing compared to the mayhem of the real battles that Merlo had lived through during the Second World War when he served as a Marine. Merlo was the cleft in the rock, the safe harbor for which Williams had prayed both on stage and off. By December 1949, Williams had completed a kitchen sink version of The Rose Tattoo. The play is a tale about Serafina, a widowed seamstress who is liberated from her morbid grief by the accidental arrival of Alvaro Mangiacavallo, a clownish, life-giving, physical replica of her dead truck driver husband. The story celebrated Williams' deliverance from a creative and emotional stalemate. Inevitably, as his bond with Merlo solidified, the landscape of his play took on deeper coloration. When he submitted the play to Kazan in June 1950, he wrote,
"During the past 2 years, I have been, for the first time in my life, happy and at home with someone, and I think of this play as a monument to that happiness."
Williams honored Merlo's inspiration in a significant way. He gave him a percentage of the play. Intimacy required equality. The money went some way to ensuring it. Merlo's tales of his Sicilian community, with its aggressions and repressions, its emotional extravagance, excited Williams's imagination and suited his rhythm. Having labored so fiercely to finish the Rose Tattoo and to get it to Wood before the new year, Williams found her silence deafening. By the end of January, he cabled Wood for a response. Wood wired back that she was very optimistic and thought it had the making of a great commercial vehicle. Williams saw through her well-chosen words, which made him feel
that the script might be something to pretend had not happened, like public vomiting.
In late February, Williams got an enthusiastic response from Kazan, who was already in pre-production with the screen version of A Streetcar Named Desire. Williams replied,
"Your letter about the play makes it possible for me to go on with it. You have a passion for organization, for seeing things in sharp focus, which I don't have, and which makes our combination a good one."
By his own admission, Kazan was then the most powerful director in America. He had successfully mounted the mid-century's three most important Broadway plays: Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth, Williams's A Streetcar Named Desire, and Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Kazan, Kazan, the miracle man, call him in as soon as you can, went a bit of Broadway doggerel about his extraordinary prowess. The streamlined final draft of The Rose Tattoo, completed 10 months later, had little in common with the kitchen sink version. The storytelling now sparkled with a new impressionism, a theatrical shorthand in which Williams's familiar lyricism was not purely verbal, but lay in his orchestration of the visual with the verbal. As Kazan had suggested, though he didn't in the end direct it, The Rose Tattoo became about the unlocking of the widow's frozen heart. Williams balanced the operatic passion of his widow, Serafina, with the tortured awareness of his own melancholy and stalled life, giving the widow a compelling new dimension. Serafina's second chance at life, with the uncouth Mancia-Cavallo, the improbable figure who lures the widow back to life, was a slapstick simulacrum of Williams's relationship with Merlot. In the name of comedy, Williams steered the final version past heartache to an intimation of wholeness. At his new home in Key West, less than a week before The Rose Tattoo's Broadway opening, Williams, full of cold medicine and seconal, sat up in the early hours listening to Merlot breathing beside him. He scribbled in his notebook,
4 days now, and we will know. Seems like the whole future hangs on it. I mustn't ever again permit myself to care this much about any public success. It makes you little and altogether too vulnerable."
Although the New York Post condescended to Williams, intermittently satisfactory, and the New York Journal brushed him off, "Play isn't worthy of the fine acting," Brooks Atkinson for the New York Times was the person whose endorsement meant the most to the playwright. Atkinson wrote, "His folk comedy about a Sicilian family living on the Gulf Coast is original, imaginative, and tender." Despite the mixed reception, Williams could still put his feet up on the railings of his Key West porch and relax with some satisfaction. He told Irene Selznick,
"If it had been a smash hit like Streetcar or a dismal failure like Summer and Smoke, it would have been, either way, bad for me. As it is, I think it provides what is most essential, a bridge to the future."
And at the same time tomorrow, you can hear Damien Lewis continue to read from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh by John Lahr. Trevor White was the voice of Tennessee Williams. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
Only through time, time is constant.
So restless Cromwell could not cease in the...
All changed. Changed utterly.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates National Poetry Day with an exploration of four major historical events that inspired vivid verse.
Anarchy, to thee we bow, be thy name made holy now.
including the works of Shelley and T.S. Eliot, The Poetry of History, over on BBC Radio 4 Extra, from Tuesday afternoon at 1:30 and again in the evening at 8:30.